From Community Public Radio, this is the CPR News. From New York, I'm Don DeBar. Ecuador's President Rafael Correa waved his country's national flag from the balcony of the Carondelet Palace in Quito Wednesday during a rally of supporters of his citizens' revolution. The massive show of public support for the president followed his firing last week of Ecuador's top military staff. For more, we spoke with our reporter from south of the border, Tony Solo.
What do you think would happen in the United States if Obama fired his military high command? And in Ecuador, that what happened was that the army sold a bunch of land to, I think it was to the health ministry, or was it? No, it wasn't. It was the Institute of Social Security. And they overcharged them by something like $41 million, which in a country the size of Ecuador, I mean, is a very significant amount of money. I should imagine it's a significant amount of money almost anywhere.
Yep.
And when Rafael Correa suggested to the Army High Command that they pay that money back, they made this very overt manipulative plea to the rank and file of the Ecuadorian military armed forces, alleging that the president was and the government was trying to impoverish the pension fund of the Ecuadorian armed forces, which was completely false. And so Rafael Correa fired them. It looks as though he had a lot of support for that, certainly from institutional support from the civil administration institutions, but one or two of the figures that got fired have very close relations with the Ecuadorian opposition.
London taxi drivers held another protest Wednesday against what they called unfair competition from U.S. company Uber and other app-based taxi services. Since Uber's introduction in Britain, drivers of the city's famous black cabs have argued it and similarly modeled firms bypass local licensing and safety laws, amounting to unfair competition. The cabbies staged a massive slowdown demonstration that brought traffic in the center of London to a standstill from Trafalgar Square to Victoria Street. Is there trouble in NATO paradise?
Hey, America!
Oh, America!
Siz bizimle beraber misiniz?
You either side with us or those terrorist organizations. You haven't had a good grasp of them, and that's why the region has turned into a sea of blood.
That was Turkey's President Recep Erdogan Wednesday. Erdogan's comments had the U.S. State Department in full damage control mode. RT's Gayan Chichikayan was at the State Department's daily press briefing with department spokesperson Mark Toner Wednesday and filed this report.
The U.S. State Department is really going out of its way to downplay this. They keep saying Turkey is such a valuable partner and ally, but that ally has just accused Washington of creating a quote-unquote a sea of blood by supporting Kurdish fighters. So I had a question for the State Department here.
We hear the State Department say all the time how good of a partner and ally Turkey is, but is it something that you expect to hear from a good partner and ally?
We understand their concerns, the threat that they feel from the PKK, and frankly from the YPG. We disagree on the YPG. We believe that they're focused on fighting Daesh within Syria, and we've supported them in that effort.
The U.S. relies on Syrian Kurds to fight Daesh. Turkey says these Syrian Kurdish fighters themselves are terrorists. I asked the State Department if the U.S. and Turkey have different priorities in this fight. The spokesman said what they have is a disagreement over this or that Kurdish group.
Kurdish fighters, Turkey thinks that they're terrorists and obviously wants somebody to attack them, and Daesh is attacking them. Do you think Turkey is in good faith? Would be fighting Daesh?
No, and I don't want to create, again, and Turkey recognizes that Daesh is a real threat, frankly, to the region and to Turkey itself, and they're a committed member of the anti-Daesh coalition.
So Daesh is fighting Syrian Kurds. Turkey is fighting Syrian Kurds. this does seem to raise the question how motivated Turkey really is when fighting Daesh.
Meanwhile, the U.S. Wednesday accused Russia of bombing two hospitals in the Syrian city of Aleppo, while Russia released evidence that the U.S., and not Russia, bombed the city Wednesday. Russia's defense ministry reported that two U.S. Air Force A-10 Thunderbolt II assault warplanes carried out airstrikes on Aleppo Wednesday, the day that the Pentagon accused Moscow of bombing the two Aleppo hospitals. Moscow said there were no Russian flights over the city Wednesday. The situation in Syria was discussed again Wednesday at the UN. Russia's permanent representative to the UN, Vitaly Churkin, spoke to the press outside the Security Council chamber, followed by Syria's permanent representative, Bashar al-Ja'afari.
We had another lengthy discussion of the humanitarian situation in Syria and also the situation in the political process in Syria, which we believe is very relevant and appropriate in the context of the situation there, very grave situation, and the meeting of the International Syria Support Group, which is to take tomorrow, is to take place tomorrow in Munich. Well, unfortunately, we believe that, you can cross the line between looking seriously and working seriously on humanitarian issues and then crossing into political exploitation of those humanitarian issues. We believe that the Security Council, some members of the Security Council have crossed that line, and they rather crudely use humanitarian matters in order to play, we believe, a destructive role as far as the political process is concerned. You will recall that when the Vienna process was taking place, two meetings of the Vienna group, first on October 30, then on November 14, Russia was arguing for discussing the ceasefire on the ground. Then some members of the group supporting the opposition said that that was not possible, that ceasefire must be only considered in the context the progress in political settlement. Of course, in order to have that progress in a political settlement, you need to have political talks. But as soon as this Ariad opposition group came to Geneva, they started raising various preconditions, humanitarian and otherwise, in order to avoid sitting at the same table with Stefan de Mistura, let alone the Syrian government. So we have seen it before. Every time there was a serious political effort, there was a huge outcry about one particular area or one particular issue. Was it Holmes or something else on the eve of major meetings, Geneva 1, Geneva 2, we always saw that. So we cannot but regard it as a politically destructive tactics. Now, as to the actions of the Syrian forces supported by the Russian Air Force, our Western colleagues on the eve of Geneva 2 used to say that some balance on the ground must be restored. So if there is some change in the balance on the ground, then that should be taken as a logical development in any armed conflict. Our armed forces, we're not about to be apologetic about what we're doing. We're acting in a very transparent manner. Daily briefings are being conducted by our Ministry of Defense. We are there, we are present there legally at the invitation of the Syrian government. In contrast to what the so-called U.S.-led coalition is doing in Syria, where they're acting outside of international law and incidentally never telling anybody what exactly they're doing in Syria or Iraq, what their targets are, what the results of their campaigns are, and also refusing our cooperation to fight terrorists on the ground. And so we think a strategy in the Security Council, the use of time of the Security Council, which could be used better for other purposes rather than having endless meetings on the same situation. Incidentally, now that we see this heightened interest of the Security Council on humanitarian matters, we are prepared to take that up. The Spanish representative said that they are going to convene the seventh meeting of the Council on the humanitarian situation in Syria. So we responded that we are going to propose weekly meetings on the humanitarian situation in Yemen till a political settlement is reached there. And given this heightened interest of the Security Council to humanitarian matters, we need to revisit the humanitarian situation in Libya. You will recall that in late 2011 we raised the issue of the civilian victims of NATO bombings in Libya, only to be rudely rebuffed by our Western colleagues, who said basically, what are you talking about? The mission has been accomplished, the regime has been changed, Gaddafi has been killed. What civilian casualties are you talking about? Despite the fact that High Commissioner for Human Rights, Ms. Pillay at that time, did say in the open session of the Security Council that the issue of civilian casualties must be looked into, and at the very least, apology and compensation should be offered to the families of the victims of those bombings. The Libyan dossier, the Libyan file, was transferred to ICC. We are not aware of any action which has been taken by ICC in order to investigate that. So we propose to hold at some point in the near future a meeting on the humanitarian situation in Libya, inviting Mr. O'Brien, High Commissioner for Human Rights, and a representative of ICC, in order to compare the situation. 2010-2016, I think it would be a very interesting comparison, and also very important to discuss that in light of the current efforts to achieve political settlement in Libya. I also told my colleagues in the Security Council that this propagandistic use of the Syrian humanitarian file is not going to deter Russia from doing the humanitarian work we are doing. With the Syrian government also, we are discussing possible cooperation with the World Food Program. Their initial reaction to our airdrops in Deir ez-Zor was sort of skeptical, if not to say negative, but then we were approached by them, telling us that they think that there is room for practical cooperation between us on those matters. And also we are discussing various possibilities of cooperation, humanitarian cooperation with the United States. So we'll continue to do the actual humanitarian work, and we'll continue to push for a political solution, a speedy resumption of the talks. We're going to do that tomorrow in Munich and in our work in the Security Council.
I have a question. The first one I want to ask you about reports that Turkey and Saudi Arabia are considering sending troops into Syria. I want your comments about that. And the second question is, have you discussed with Mr. Demastura the participation of PYD, the Kurds, in the talks? Well, is that possible?
First of all, the most important position is that of the Syrian government, which has declared that a military move by Turkey of Saudi Arabia into the Syrian territory will be regarded as an act of aggression. Clearly, that would be a move of serious military escalation, and certainly I don't see how it can help the prospects of a political settlement. Yes, we do believe that as we are preparing for the resumption of the talks, and hopefully even before February 25, additional work needs to be done on making the opposition more representative, not just the Ariad people, which did not exhibit sufficient dedication to the talks, having basically tried to walk out of the talks when Mr. Demastura announced this pause on the talks, but also the Cairo-Moscow platform and the Syrian Kurds must be represented there. I spoke about that before. For us, to discuss the future of Syria, if we are talking about the territorial integrity of Syria, without the Syrian Kurds controlling a large number of the territory, large population, completely it does not make sense at all. So we hope that by the time the talks are reconvened, all those matters would be settled.
Especially that the opposition stopped its engagement last time because of the military operations on the ground.
Well, I think that definitely there is a chance, and definitely this is the intention, I think, of the responsible members of the international group for support of Syria. It is the intention of the Secretary General, with whom I discussed this matter yesterday. And, let's see. We hope that the meeting tomorrow in Munich will help pave the way for a speedy resumption of the talks.
Yes, Mr. Ambassador, the news said that Russia has presented a new peace proposal presented to the American side. Can you share with us
No, I can't. We have a number of discussions with the United States, including the possibility of a ceasefire and also some humanitarian discussions. Very important discussions, too.
Thank you, Mr. Ambassador. Are you saying, I realize that you have permission, Russia has permission from the Syrian government for its actions in Aleppo. But are you implying that the opposition to Damascus in the Aleppo area, that they're all terrorists or what?
Well, we're implying that they have been holding large segments of the territory and they have been using their position, among other things. And Turkey has been using that position as a lifeline for terrorists. And weapons to come from their territory to the region of Aleppo. So hopefully if the situation and when the situation is corrected, there will be more optimism for a political settlement. Please.
The Shamia Front, which is an umbrella organization involving most of the armed groups in Syria, which are some of them consider them moderate, have aligned with Nusra and Daesh in the neighborhood of Halab. Now, how would that affect the negotiations with the so-called moderates?
Well, that's that, of course, would affect everything very negatively. This is one of the things which I'm sure they are going to discuss tomorrow in Munich, because the idea, as you know, in the course of the Vienna process, was to come up with a joint understanding of who the terrorists are. I mean, everybody agrees that ISIL and al-Nusra and some other groups are terrorists, but there are some other groups which are sort of in the gray area. We may regard them as terrorists, others refuse to regard them as terrorists. So that is something which is going to be discussed tomorrow, because when we talk about the ceasefire, of course, there can be no ceasefire with terrorists. There can be no ceasefire with ISIL. And this is, I believe, a clear understanding among members of the International Syria Support Group. Thank you very much.
The Russian ambassador didn't leave too much for me to say. However, allow me to add the following clarifications. As you know, some member states of the Security Council have had a kind of focus and obsession with regard addressing the issue of Syria. But they don't want to address it politically. They want to address it selectively through the so-called humanitarian aspect, which is for them the best channel to politicize the whole discussions on Syria within the framework of the Security Council. Having said that, I would like to tell you that what I mean by this is that politicizing the humanitarian situation, whether in Syria or elsewhere, is a kind of cover-up for these specific member states' involvement and complicity in sponsoring, training, protecting, and arming the terrorist groups operating all over of the Syrian territory, whether in the north of Aleppo, or in the south next to the Jordanian border. The Syrian government is fighting the terrorists, the same kind of terrorists, sponsored by the same guys, the Saudis, the Turks, the Qataris, the French, and others. So there is nothing new with this regard. It has been a kind of circle, vicious circle, that we are trying to address every time the Security Council is dealing with this humanitarian issue. They don't address the humanitarian issue in Yemen. They don't address it in Palestine. They don't address it in Iraq. They have a full-fledged obsession about addressing the so-called humanitarian situation in Syria. While doing so, they don't tell you that up to 75% of the humanitarian needs in Syria are covered by the Syrian government. They don't tell you that the Syrian government, through the Syrian Red Crescent Association and OCHA, is covering even the needs of the so-called hard-to-reach areas. I'm using the expression, the favored expression used by OCHA. Of course, they wouldn't tell you that. They wouldn't tell you that because that would be a credit for the Syrian government, and they don't have any intention to put anything in the credit of the Syrian government. So the focus on what's going on in Aleppo right now, by misusing the humanitarian dimension of the issue, is nothing but a cover-up of their political failure, because the Syrian army has liberated huge swathes of territories which were controlled previously by the same terrorist that some people claim fighting through the Security Council non-fulfilled resolutions on combating terrorism. Here I'm referring to, of course, to 2253 and other resolutions, famous resolutions, none of them which are not implemented, as you know, efficiently by the same member states who have called repeatedly for dealing with the humanitarian issue in Syria. So it's this kind of sessions has only one target, one objective: defaming the Syrian government, defaming the Syrian government's allies such as Russia, criticizing all the advances, the successful advances of the Syrian military army and the Syrian army in the field. Of course, this is definitely a kind of concern for them, because we are defeating those who are helped by the same guys who are claiming dealing with the humanitarian situation in Syria, or they have some kind of concerns, illegitimate concerns, with regard the humanitarian situation in Syria. Who created this humanitarian situation in Syria? Themselves. They speak about thousands of Syrians leaving Aleppo, of course, because the terrorists have been using the civilians as humanitarian shields in Aleppo. So it is not the government which is purchasing these innocent civilians outside of their villages. It is the terrorists who are using them as humanitarian shields. And then definitely the Turkish government is closing, as you know, the border, because it's an excellent tool of pressure, an excellent tool of propaganda that can be used by the Turkish regime with this regard. The Turkish regime and the handlers of the Turkish regime in the Security Council. So it is really unfortunate to find ourselves once again, victims as Syrians of a kind of political manipulation and a kind of political speculations within the Security Council itself by some member states. I'm in your hands. Yes. Uyghur, Chinese. Yeah. The Chinese, yes, the Uyghur.
And you also mentioned that during the, week-long visit to Mecca, Saudi Arabia.
Yes, 4 years, four decades, yes. They offered them free tickets and free journey within the territory, Saudi territories, for almost 1 month.
You mentioned that they were being trained by terrorists.
Yes. No, they were trained to follow the Wahhabism, which means the radical Islamism theory implemented and applied by the Saudi regime. Daesh, meaning the ISIL, the same school of thoughts of ISIL. Wahhabism is ISIL,
and
radicalism.
They return and actively destabilize.
Not only in China, now they brought them in Syria. We have 3,500 families from the Uyghurs, Chinese, in the countryside of Aleppo. They came with their wives, their grandmother, grandchildren. They think that they are coming to live in the shadow of the so-called Islamic Khalifa, Khilafa. They are manipulating these naive people by misleading them and telling them that they are coming for jihad and for living in the shadow of the Islamic Khilafah. They did the same in Iraq, they did the same elsewhere. It is the same school of thought. It is the Wahhabism in its worse version. Yes, they are not misusing the Uyghur only. They are misusing everybody. We have people from Uzbekistan, from Kyrgyzstan, from Kyrgyzstan, Tajikistan. I mean, they are collecting this garbage from all these countries and sending them to Syria and Iraq. And of course, they are doing the same phenomenon in Africa through Boko Haram. The focal point of this international terrorism, called, wrongly speaking, jihadism, is Libya. Yes.
The Russian foreign minister has said he's going to put forward new proposals for ceasefire tomorrow in Munich. Is this something that your government supports? And you've been leading the negotiations in Geneva. The opposition said today that they would not participate as long as the bombing and humanitarian access is blocked. Could we get your reaction? Thank you.
We are not aware of any details related to this so-called initiative. But definitely, if there is anything concrete that will come out of these discussions, the Syrian government will be aware of that through our friends and allies. But you know what? We have had a huge arsenal to go ahead with the political settlement, the political solution. We went to Geneva based on the resolution 2254, 2253, 2170, 2178, 2199, 2191, and you name it. So we have this huge arsenal as a basis for discussion. But you know what? The point is that we went to Geneva as a disciplined delegation, governmental delegation, and we didn't find in front of us anybody serious, any other delegation, any other seriousness. Even the Mistura himself didn't know how, whether this group of Riyadh would come or not. They came 3 days late, as you know. They didn't go to the Palais des Nations. The Mistura went to them at the hotel. So they didn't engage seriously in anything related to the indirect political discussions through the special envoy. This is number one. Number two, there has been a very bad preparations for this indirect talks. From the beginning, we didn't know how many delegations would come, how many oppositions would come, in plural. The Mistura himself didn't know. People waited in Geneva for a week and he wasn't aware of their presence, although they had visas and they were considered oppositions. He selected some people without prior consultation with the Syrian government or the other parties. So there were too many huge gaps into the structure itself of the meeting, of the indirect discussions in Geneva. And then, of course, the absence of any commitment, political commitment on the other side, on the side of the group of Riyadh. Since the first day they arrived, they jumped out of the plane and they started saying, by Thursday, if the Syrian government doesn't do that, this and this and this and that, we would withdraw by Thursday. And they did it, because they got the orders from their handlers in Riyadh. The Saudi Minister for Foreign Affairs told them on Wednesday, one day before they withdrew, you can withdraw. And then they got the same message from Davud Oglu, the Turkish Prime Minister. So they got instructions from their handlers in Riyadh and Ankara, and they withdrew from discussions that did not start, actually, to be honest with you. We were just discussing, as Syrian government delegation and the special envoy, the procedures and the form. We haven't touched the substance, because we were alone discussing with the Mistura. The other side didn't show up.
Do you believe now the military option is viable, and do you see it feasible now?
We have always said that there are two tracks. The political track is separate from the other track based on combating terrorism. Combating terrorism has been legitimized by the Security Council Resolution 2254. So there is no contradiction between these two tracks. The Syrian government is deeply engaged into the political track. Not only the Syrian government and our allies and our friends and the so-called international community. Everybody tells you the same, but they don't follow their words by their by real deeds. So the political track goes on, whether in Geneva or elsewhere, and the other track based on combating terrorism will continue unconditionally. Thank you so much.
And that's all the news we have for you right now. For Community Public Radio, I'm Don DeBar in New York. Thanks for listening.